Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Julian Chang, your host for tonight's program, The Truth About Truvada, featuring Dr. Robert Grant and Dana Van Gorder. Tonight's program is sponsored by the LGBT member-led forum of the Commonwealth Club. It's my pleasure to extend a special and warm welcome to any new club members who are here. We know you will enjoy your membership, and we look forward to seeing you often. I'd also like to tell you, new members and also our current members, that the member-led forums are created by volunteers for the Commonwealth Club. And I invite each one of you to participate with ideas and suggestions, or at the very least, please let us know what specific topic of interest you would like us to discuss at an upcoming event. You can pick up a copy of the Commonwealth Club publication in the lobby, or check out our website for a complete listing of events. Many exciting programs are offered each week, and you can register online for the programs at commonwealthclub.org or by calling the club's 24-hour reservation line. There are question cards on each of your seats, and these will be collected during the program. We are recording the program for possible broadcast on radio, which is very exciting. And so please make sure now that all your cell phones and other noise-making devices are turned off. Tonight's program is timely because in the run-up to World AIDS Day, we are discussing one of the most important breakthroughs in 2012 with two of the premier experts in the United States on HIV/AIDS. Tonight, our moderator is Dana Van Gorder, and our featured speaker is Dr. Robert Grant. Dana Van Gorder is currently the executive director of Project Inform, a national nonprofit agency assisting in the development of treatments for HIV infection, providing treatment information to HIV-positive individuals, engaging in advocacy to meet the healthcare needs of low-income HIV-positive people, and advocating for biomedical prevention strategies. In this role, Dana has helped lead national efforts to assure implementation of HIV treatment as prevention through his work as a member of the Steering Committee for a National HIV/AIDS Strategy. He is also working to support the implementation of pre-exposure prophylaxis for gay and bisexual men as a member of the National PrEP Working Group. From 2000 to 2008, he served as a director of state and local policy for the San Francisco AIDS Foundation. In that role, Dana developed and monitored legislation and advocated for funding to assure the highest possible response to the epidemic in California. He also secured $10 million in funding for a statewide campaign to prevent methamphetamine abuse among gay and bisexual men. Dana served as a coordinator of the Lesbian and Gay Health Services for the San Francisco Department of Public Health from 1995 to 2000. During that time, he was extensively involved in research and writing regarding psychosocial determinants of risky sexual behavior among gay and bisexual men, and led the first efforts to address rising levels of methamphetamine use in this community. Dana is a former legislative aide to two members of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, Harry Britt and Carol Migden. He has served as a consultant on a number of political campaigns, including California's statewide AIDS initiative campaigns, and has served as a community relations director for two international AIDS conferences. Dana is also a founder of the San Francisco Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Community Center Project, which celebrates its 10th year anniversary this year. Originally conceived to address psychosocial needs of gay and bisexual men in support of HIV and STD prevention. Welcome, Dana Van Gorder.
Thank you.
Our speaker tonight is Dr. Robert Grant. Bob Grant is a senior investigator at the Gladstone Institute of Virology and Immunology and a professor of medicine at the University of California in San Francisco. Dr. Grant has 28 years of experience with HIV/AIDS research and clinical care, including 11 years of experience with studies of post- and pre-exposure prophylaxis. He is the protocol chair of the IPREX trial called chemoprophylaxis for HIV prevention in men, which was funded by the NIH and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Results of the IPREX trial were listed among 2010's top 10 medical breakthroughs by Time Magazine. He's also the protocol chief of HPTN-067, called ADAPT study, for alternative dosing to augment PrEP tablet use. He is a co-investigator for the FemPrep trial, the CDC-sponsored safety study of PrEP safety in U.S. MSM, and the West African PrEP study. Dr. Grant serves on the PrEP trial list, working group, and acts as an advisor to the WHO, UNAIDS, CDC, and Gilead regarding the prevention use of antiretroviral therapy. Dr. Grant's laboratory is also interested in HIV-1 superinfection, drug resistance, and mutagenesis. In 2011, Dr. Grant received the Leadership Award from the San Francisco AIDS Foundation. And in this year, 2012, he is listed among Time Magazine's 100 most influential people in the world. Welcome, Dr. Robert Grant.
Thank you, Julian, and thank you to all of you for your interest. It was a particularly kind introduction indeed. I have been doing HIV research for 28 years, but I'm not bragging. Let me tell you about something my teenage daughter said when she was upset about my work cutting into my duties as her chauffeur. She says, "So, Dad, you've been working on HIV for 28 years. I said, "Yes, dear, I have, for twice as long as you have been alive." She says, "And I know you work really hard." "Yes, I work very hard, which is why I can't drive you to the beach right now." And she said, there's still no vaccine and no cure." I said, "Nope, not yet." She said, "Well, maybe you would be better at something else." So she should not be so pessimistic about ending AIDS or her ability to sucker me into driving her to the beach. Both may well happen, depending on how the conversation goes. Tonight we will discuss how we could stop the HIV epidemic and how new discoveries related to treatment and prevention have created a promise to end transmission and clinical disease related to HIV. We will also discuss tonight why AIDS is not ending. The barriers to our success are no longer purely technical, but are really political and social. These issues call for broad discussion of engaged citizens, which is why I'm pleased to come speak to the Commonwealth Club. But let us first recount where we have been. HIV is now known to have crossed over into people from its natural chimpanzee and monkey host species about 100 years ago. The virus did not spread in people very extensively until there were social disruptions in Africa in the 1970s and 80s. At that time, civil war and new trade routes ruptured social systems, transported young men to war, shortened people's life expectations, and created opportunities for this newly humanized virus to spread. The virus spread quickly to all continents. Now that it was adapted to exploit people's most human desire for intimacy, procreation, and sex. From the beginning, the shape of the epidemic and its timing were socially determined. At this time, 64 million people have been infected with HIV, and nearly 30 million people have died. There are 34 million living with HIV. Even small children, like my daughter, know there is no cure and no vaccine. Staying alive after HIV infection requires lifelong therapy. This is one of our worst epidemics. The HIV epidemic continues to spread. Worldwide, there are 2.5 million new HIV infections per year. In the United States, there are 50,000 new infections per year. On average, one person is newly infected in San Francisco every single day. During this one-hour talk, there will be 5 to 6 new infections in the United States. These rates of new infection have not substantially changed over the last 20 years, despite widespread knowledge of how the virus spreads and the protective benefits of condoms. The majority of new infections occur in young people between the ages of 16 and 24, before they learn ways to protect themselves and during phases of their lives when they are exploring their social and sexual roles. Gay men have 19-fold higher odds of being infected compared with the general population on all continents. The majority of people who acquire HIV are heterosexual, half are women. There is a new complacency about HIV. Why not be complacent? There are effective therapies, and now more effective prevention strategies. Furthermore, people with HIV are tired of being defined by their infection. They want to be known for their work, the people they love, and by their names, not the result of a blood test. So the reason not to be complacent, the problem with HIV, is that new information is not being used. Overall, in the United States, only 1 in 5 people with HIV infection is receiving effective therapy. Effective therapy is required to prolong life and to prevent transmission. The barriers to treatment are well known and include late diagnosis of infection, inadequate supply of health services, fear of accessing HIV services, and poor retention and care. These barriers create a gulf between the promise of modern treatment and the reality of HIV spread. All of these barriers are related to stigma, which will be the topic of the majority of my comments. If anything, the availability of technologies increases disparities in healthcare. Again, social aspects are propagating the epidemic. This is a time of great optimism. This year, we heard Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton call for an AIDS-free generation. This is a bold statement based on new findings from research and the new creation of a healthcare system in the United States. So what accounts for optimism for an AIDS-free generation? Well, first, we now know that the same therapies that prolong life of HIV-infected people also decrease infectiousness, or the chance that treated people will infect their partners. The benefit is striking. Treated people did not transmit HIV to their stable sexual partners after starting treatment. The drug cocktails have proven to be a triple ripple. They prolong life of the treated person, prevent transmission of HIV, and prevent tuberculosis disease. Based on these results, the governments of San Francisco and New York now recommend that everyone should be offered therapy as soon as they are diagnosed with HIV infection. National guidelines were changed this year to recommend starting therapy earlier than ever before. The second discovery is the finding and the experience that providing combination therapy to pregnant women with other aspects of good maternal care has virtually eliminated the transmission of HIV from mothers to infants in the United States. The last infection to an infant in San Francisco was more than 10 years ago. There were 15 per year on average before that. This is encouraging because it shows that prevention works, and further that we have the political will and administrative systems needed to implement what works, at least when mothers and infants are concerned. Whether we can muster the same political will when adults are being infected remains to be seen. So the third major discovery is the one that I'm proud to have been involved in. We found that the same drugs that prolong life when used for treatment can also be used by uninfected people to protect themselves from acquiring HIV infection. Called pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP, we find that uninfected people were highly protected when they took the pills. For example, among gay men whose drug levels in their bodies indicated daily use of PrEP, there was a 99% reduction in HIV acquisition. This benefit of 99% reduction in HIV acquisition was in addition to the benefits that come from counseling and condom promotion, which were provided to everyone in the study. The prevention pill, or PrEP, also works well for heterosexual men and women. PrEP was particularly beneficial for people who were not using condoms consistently. There are many circumstances that lead to inconsistent condom use. Condoms are a non-starter for couples who desire pregnancy and tend to be used less if the couple is in love or if there is erectile dysfunction or if the sexual encounter is rushed. The drug combination called Truvada in the United States was approved by the FDA for prevention use in July of 2012, and the CDC and WHO have issued guidance for use. So the fourth major advance has been related to male circumcision. Male circumcision is a simple surgery that provides lifelong protection against HIV infection, reducing the risk of acquiring HIV by 60% or more. We have known for decades that the burden of the epidemic is greater in parts of the world where circumcision was rare. But recent randomized trials, a rigorous form of study, demonstrated that circumcision itself had a role in explaining the decreased burden of disease among circumcised people. While there have been concerns that people would not be willing to be circumcised, we have seen in parts of South Africa and in Kenya that more than half of those eligible have been circumcised and interest is on the rise. People will take steps to keep themselves free of HIV even if it involves surgery. This approach is only known to be effective for heterosexual men. So the fifth major advance has been related to testing. It has never been easier to get tested for HIV infection. We have rapid tests that give a result within 15 minutes and are highly accurate. One of these tests is now approved by the FDA for home use. So HIV testing is now as easy as a pregnancy test. The CDC now recommends that all adults should have an HIV test at least once, and more frequently if there is potential exposure to HIV. Finally, from a policy point of view, the United States now has a national HIV and AIDS strategy, thanks in part to Dana Van Gorder, who's with us tonight. The strategy makes a commitment to make the United States a place where HIV transmission is rare. This blueprint and the Affordable Health Care Act make it possible for the first time to conceive of nationwide strategies for implementing new knowledge. This is a work in progress, and the list of essential services is still to be defined. Hence, we all now have historic opportunities to shape the future of healthcare in the United States, and we can do it in a way that accelerates the end of the HIV and AIDS epidemic in the United States. To summarize, new findings indicate several highly effective ways to prevent the spread of HIV infection. These include early treatment of pregnant women, PrEP for uninfected persons, male circumcision, all of these triggered by easy HIV testing. Scaling up these services could end transmission. Recently, in addition, there have been promising findings that could herald even more potent ways to stem the epidemic. There are two that I would like to highlight tonight. First, a vaccine was found to be partially effective in a clinical trial in Thailand, reducing infection rates by a third in a study that involved tens of thousands of people. While this level of vaccine efficacy was low and was regarded to be too low to implement the vaccine widely, this is a proof of concept that may herald the way to more effective vaccines for HIV prevention. In addition, there's now proof of concept that a cure of HIV is possible. The one pioneering case of a cure is a man who is now under the care of physicians at the University of California, San Francisco. His name and history have been published with his permission, so nothing I will say is a breach of his confidentiality. While in Germany, he had HIV infection and then developed leukemia, a blood cancer. He ended up needing a stem cell transplant to treat his cancer. His doctors in Berlin were clever and decided to give him cells from a donor who was genetically resistant to HIV infection. Such genetic resistance is conferred by the absence of a protein receptor that the virus uses to get into cells. It's called CCR5. After the transplant, the so-called Berlin patient stopped antiretroviral therapy or anti-HIV therapy, and his virus has not come back. His leukemia remains in remission as well. This is being called a functional cure. Functional because the virus is probably still present at extremely low levels in his body, but a cure nonetheless because the virus remains at bay in the absence of daily therapy. Stem cell transplantation is a Herculean approach and has risks of its own. So it is currently warranted only for people who have a cancer that cannot be treated as effectively with less aggressive therapy. Nonetheless, the This is a promising precedent that is being actively explored in industry and academic settings. The potential for a functional cure of HIV has been established. So we know several ways to block HIV transmission and to prevent HIV disease among those who are infected. Further, we have proven that such approaches can eliminate transmission of HIV from pregnant women to their infants on large scales. Why do we still have 50,000 new infections every year in the United States and 2.5 million new HIV infections worldwide? Well, we are slow to implement new knowledge. As an example, we first published that PrEP, or the prevention pill, was highly effective for preventing HIV transmission to gay men on Thanksgiving week 2010, 24 months ago. The news reached 2 billion people in the following 2 days and was heralded as the most important medical discovery in 2010 by Time magazine. The finding was accepted by the scientific community, and the CDC issued guidance for use on the same day. Barack Obama issued a statement that it was a groundbreaking discovery that would enable progress toward the newly minted National HIV and AIDS Strategy. Clinicians braced for a flood of demand for the HIV prevention pill. And then what happened? There's been no systematic implementation, although the drug is available in every pharmacy in the nation because it is already being used for treatment. More interestingly, there was virtually no demand for a pill that claimed to reduce risk for risky men. Why no action? Well, for one thing, regulatory process takes time, to be sure. Innovations in medicine appropriately involve regulatory review by the FDA in the United States. The WHO plays a role in providing normative guidance internationally. These review processes started within a week of the publication. The CDC in the United States acted within days, as they were already familiar with the promise and issues of PrEP, having played a leadership role in the development of the concept. However, the FDA and WHO took 18 months to act. Decisions were made that evidence about PrEP efficacy from gay men was not enough, not even to issue guidance for gay men. So information from heterosexual populations would be needed for them. Mind you, there is no public health reason why interventions tailored for one subgroup cannot move forward. And there is precedent for rolling out antiviral interventions for only one subgroup for whom there is information. For example, valacyclovir was approved for preventing herpes transmission among heterosexual couples without any information being available from other subgroups, including gay men. This was FDA approved in a timely fashion and was made available to heterosexual populations. In contrast, the PrEP strategy for protecting gay men was put on hold until it could be evaluated in heterosexuals as well. Fortunately, evidence from the heterosexual trials became available within 7 months in July 2011. At that time, there was clear evidence that the PrEP prevention pill was good for preventing acquisition in gay men, heterosexual couples, and heterosexual men and women. So then what happened? It was 12 months before the FDA review process was completed in July 2012. The WHO independently issued guidance for pilot studies for PrEP in the same month. These projects have still not been funded, except for 3 projects in California funded by the University of California and 1 project funded by the NIH, only to be implemented in San Francisco and Miami. The first of these demonstration projects started a full 2 years after the publication of PrEP efficacy and is rolled out in only 2 cities in the United States. So what's going on? Why the delay? I've been asked by skeptics what would happen if we found a way to stop the HIV epidemic. Would we do it? This is the question we have to ask tonight, because we know how to stop the epidemic, and we're not doing it, not yet. So why the delay? I believe that at heart, that stigma and deliberate ignorance are standing in our way. I hope to show you how we all participate in these social processes of stigma and deliberate ignorance. My ambition tonight is not to embarrass anyone, especially not myself, but rather to show how today, tonight, starting now, we can take specific actions that will lead to the end of AIDS. These actions will address stigma and deliberate ignorance. First, I believe that deliberate ignorance is a part of human thought. It's rampant. We choose not to know or do research if the knowledge is deemed to be a moral hazard. For example, we knew that a vaccine against human papillomavirus, which causes cervical and anal cancer, was effective for girls before research in gay men was started. Male circumcision was never studied in gay men, although three studies have been completed in heterosexual men. Gay men in particular end up being excluded from research for fear that knowledge will be harmful. Such deliberate ignorance arises from stigma. We need to talk more about stigma. Stigma is a social process by which some people are excluded from full social membership based on some characteristic. The stigma process involves dividing people based on some readily identifiable sign that might be race, height, mental illness, hair color, sex, sexual preference, or results of an HIV test. People who have one stigmatized characteristic are assumed to have a whole cluster of negatively valued features that justify their being socially marginalized. An in-group of us is formed that excludes the out-group of them. In HIV programs, stigma is linked to HIV infection itself, sexual preference, sex, age, and even geography. So let me give an example. When we started PrEP research, we were told only to do studies in women in developing countries. Such women were regarded by our research sponsors to be the victims who needed female-controlled methods for HIV prevention when their male sex partners refused to wear condoms. No prevention pill was needed in men, we were told, because men should just behave better, and information about a prevention pill could be misused by empowered men. The assumption that new information will be misused arises from stigma. What happened next was interesting. Supposedly powerless women who were targeted for the research refused to be the sole participants. On the other hand, gay men who were excluded from the research, lined up around the block to help with the pioneering studies. We saw, surprisingly, that power and responsibility existed where none was expected, stigma notwithstanding. We were allowed to proceed with our study 3 years after we received a fundable merit score from peer reviewers and approval from the NIH Scientific Council for funding. The debates about sexual morality paralyzed the process and the science. During those 3 years of delay, nearly 8 million people were infected with HIV around the world. So this is my example of deliberate ignorance propagating the epidemic, a process that would have continued except for the demands of women and gay men for fair and equitable consideration in research process. So it is helpful to see stigma as a social process and not just hateful attitudes, speech, and action. Although clearly those are part of it. While many of the people listening to this program will desire to avoid hateful language and behavior, we all find ourselves participating in society, including the social process of stigma. Stigma is embedded in our language, where we live, the words we use, the topics we research, and the topics that we elect to remain ignorant about. Let us think of some examples of how our words, even when well-intentioned, reinforce stigma. But first let me explain my focus on words. Words are not just the stuff of poetry. I quote Nelson Mandela, the pioneering first president of Democratic South Africa, who spoke at the AIDS conference in Durban in 2000. Nelson Mandela said, "It has never been my custom to use words lightly. If 27 years in prison have done anything to us, it was to use the silence of solitude to make us understand how precious words are and how real speech is and its impact upon the way people live and die." So what words have an impact on the way people live and die now in the United States? Consider the word risk. According to the Oxford English Dictionary, the word risk was first used to refer to an adventurous course, like an explorer going out to sea looking for treasure. Such seafarers may be eaten by sea monsters, it was thought, in the course of their valiant efforts. Risk was not a bad thing at all. It was part of ambition. It was part of aspirations for a better world. It wasn't until the 20th century that the word risk came to be used to refer to people in hazardous situations, hazards that left them vulnerable to harm without the offsetting potential for benefit. Such people are no longer adventurers, but are vulnerable and victims in this view, in this meaning of the word risk. So at this point in the 20th century, the word risk started to take a primarily negative meaning. But it wasn't until the 1950s, in the McCarthy era, when the word risk came to refer to the person himself or herself, as in the risk to the state. Over this progression, from adventurer to victim to threat, the word risk became emblematic of poor character. The person became the hazard, not their situation or their aspirations. Healthy people were warned about them by the word risk, the modern scarlet letter. We use the word risk a lot in HIV research and programming. We talk about risky behavior, risky people, and risk groups. The word risk is used with the best of intentions to try to provide services to those people who cannot help themselves. However, these uses of the word are often in the latest, most stigmatized meaning. The problem is not the situation, but the person. As you might imagine, the word risk is often offensive. For example, when we announced the results that the prevention pill, or PrEP, could prevent acquisition of HIV in gay men, one of our investigators mentioned to the press that the study had recruited and enrolled high-risk men. The intention was charitable, to highlight that we had studied people who needed new prevention methods. There is, sometimes, a desire to say high-risk men instead of gay men, thinking that this might be more polite. However, several of our research participants were outraged to read that they had been called high-risk in public. They called to complain that while their friends and family were all proud of their participation in research, they did not think of themselves as high-risk. They thought of themselves as affectionate and popular and happy to help usher in needed advances in HIV prevention for themselves and for their friends. But certainly, they did not see themselves as high-risk. A few felt betrayed. Having done so much to help move things forward, they were now being maligned in the worst terms, being called risky men. So risk is a vector of stigma. The word risk is not the only vector of stigma that we inflict on ourselves and our friends. In the new era of AIDS optimism, there's an abundance of research and talk about how best to target prevention interventions to optimize impact on the spread of HIV. The notion of targeting, the word targeting, implies that there's a group who knows and another group that has to be targeted, whether they like it or not. The notion of us targeting them is stigmatizing. Yet this is the main discourse in the prevention field today. People with an unquestionable claim to be heroes in the struggle against HIV, and me too, all indulge in the stigmatizing process with the best of intentions, but with the worst of consequences. Much is said about the lack of expressed demand for prevention interventions and services, including PrEP. Imagine a young man being targeted for interventions based on his risky behavior when he was just trying to have a good time with his friends and lovers. I suspect that you too would turn away if you were targeted for high-risk behavior, like a deer runs away when targeted by a hunter. So my challenge to you, and the action that you can take today if you want to help usher in the end of AIDS, is to try to get through a day without saying the words risk, targeting, interventions, or vulnerable, as these words all invoke the notion of a knowledgeable us and a powerless and untrustworthy them. I suspect we will stumble, even in the discussion that follows. The challenge is not just to find a synonym for stigmatizing words, because the synonym would be quickly embedded with the same meanings. Rather, we should reframe the discussion about the end of AIDS. Instead of talking about risk behavior, let us talk about sex, because after all, that's what it is. Instead of talking about risky people, let us talk about we who aspire to be popular, gregarious, and affectionate. Instead of targeting, let's talk about marketing. Instead of interventions, let's talk about choosing among options. Instead of implementation, let's talk about popular trends. Instead of talking about what they need, let us talk about what we want. Commonwealth Club is a forum for policy discussions. So it's natural to ask, are there policies in the United States that interfere with putting an end to AIDS? Well, yes. There are laws against clean needle exchange for injection drug users, laws against carrying more than 3 condoms in some jurisdictions because it might mean that you're a sex worker, laws against making condoms available in some prisons, laws against sex work that make it more difficult for people to protect themselves from violence and HIV. There are many laws that make ending the HIV epidemic more difficult. The policy that I'd like to highlight before concluding is the policy against U.S. federal funding for materials and activities that promote or encourage, directly or indirectly, homosexual or heterosexual activity. This most directly applies to the development of educational materials, but also complicates sex research and HIV research. Complicates HIV and sex research in that information about sexual responses and sexual practice are sometimes feared to encourage such practices. National and state surveys of sexual practices have been halted by political leaders because of these sentiments that finding out may encourage behavior. Investigators who do sex-related research sometimes find their work receiving extra congressional inquiry even after it has been judged to be meritorious in an extremely rigorous and selective review process. We have political restrictions on sex research in the United States. Yet it seems obvious that sexual behavior is of interest, given its role in human happiness, building families, pregnancy, whether planned or unplanned, crimes, HIV transmission, and transmission of a variety of other infections, including infections that cause cancer. The National Institutes of Health have institutes for infectious disease, mental health, alcohol abuse, drug abuse, but there is no National Institute for Sexuality Studies. For sure, HIV risk behavior is allowed to be studied, but not sex. Risk behavior and sex are not the same concept. Focus only on risk behavior, HIV risk behavior, causes us to miss the point of sex, which is virtually never to create an opportunity for HIV, but rather is shaped by social, biological, and psychological processes, which can be discovered and learned about. Could it be that sex cannot be researched? After all, it is a personal behavior, and some people may be quite shy. Still, we don't think so. The pharmaceutical industry has been very effective in pursuing sex research and have found it to be extremely useful. Products that enhance sexual function are billion-dollar blockbuster moneymakers, so something useful is being learned from sex research. Sex research is occurring with limited funding at this time, typically with very interesting results. What private industry can do, however, is just related to product development. We need to know much more about how sexual decisions are made. So is restricting federal funding for sex research appropriate because of moral concerns? Morality is the proper stuff of public discourse, so we should not be surprised that sex is discussed and people have opinions about whether other people do. Still, alcohol and drug use has moral dimensions and engenders broad discussion about the war on drugs, but we still study drug use and its consequences. There's no reason why moral discussions of sexual practices should preclude knowing more about such practices, their frequency, their circumstances, especially if such knowledge could help prevent disease and foster happy families and communities. I submit that limited research on sex leads to deliberate ignorance. Let us consider an example from my work. The prevailing theory about sexual decision-making in the medical literature is called risk compensation. The theory of risk compensation assumes that sexual drives are essentially limitless and are contained only by fear of risks, especially the risk of HIV infection. The sexual decision maker is assumed to be making essentially rational decisions, weighing risks against benefits. The theory predicts that people offered a prevention pill or effective treatment or a vaccine would throw caution to the wind and have crazy times with many partners. Concerns about risk compensation cause delays in prevention research on PrEP and is slowing down the implementation of new discoveries at this time. So what do we think about the theory of risk compensation? Is it even plausible? Are we sure that sexual decisions are usually rational? A perusal of the daily paper suggests otherwise. Does anyone really believe that fear of HIV is the major determinant of sexual decisions? I submit that if it were, we would not have an epidemic. Even the notion that sex-seeking is limitless, except if contained by shame or fear, is hard to believe by anyone who's been in a long-term relationship. Enough is enough after the honeymoon is over. And what about all the motivations for sex? Pleasure seems to be just one. There's also procreation, recreation, intimacy, friendship, advancement, money, and community. All of these human desires for sex reach some level of satisfaction, suggesting that sexual drives are not limitless. In summary, the theory of risk compensation relies on premises that run counter to common sense. But what about the evidence? We're here as scientists. Is there evidence for the theory of risk compensation? In fact, there isn't. The theory predicted that circumcised men would have more partners and use condoms less. They didn't. Riskier behavior among PrEP users was predicted, but not found. When we asked people about what they were thinking, the vast majority said that they became more focused on HIV prevention after starting use of PrEP. They entered a community in which people talked about HIV, and they made plans to stay HIV-free for the rest of their lives. Sure, a few will say, heck yeah, give me a pill and I'm going to go out and make up for lost time. But this is the minority opinion, maybe 1 in 100. And as nearly as we can tell, these 1 in 100 respondents are already making up for lost time anyway, pill or no pill. Giving people a prevention pill is not inspiring sex. There is ample inspiration already. Giving people a prevention pill is just making it safer. So why do we hold dear theories of sexual decision-making that make no sense, have no evidence, and hinder our use of effective disease prevention strategies? Perhaps the theory is part of stigma, which is a part of our lives. Stigma, or the presumption that any new information will be used in an irresponsible manner, leads us not to study sex and delays research and implementation of HIV prevention strategies. So in conclusion, we now know how to end the epidemic of AIDS. We're not ending AIDS, partly because we cling to stigma, which is reinforced by the language we use and deliberate ignorance codified by public policy. The forces sustaining the AIDS epidemic in our speech are in our speech and in our policies. We can change them. I wanted to end my comments by remembering those who have died of AIDS. Talk of the end of AIDS does not mean forgetting those who have died. Our special and courageous lovers, artists, dancers, writers, athletes, entrepreneurs, chefs, designers, mothers, fathers, sons, daughters, and friends. They would give us permission to end this thing. So there's much to discuss. I've left out some of the medical details of PrEP. I'm happy to discuss those. But I think that there's broader issues related to the social impact of modern approaches to the AIDS prevention and ending the epidemic. To lead this discussion, we have Dana Van Gorder, who's my good friend and colleague, and the director of Project Inform. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob, for great, I think, comprehensive remarks about sort of where we are in the epidemic today. Let me ask you two questions. On sort of the, you know, just setting aside PrEP for one moment, but we'll come back to it. I think I know a lot of people who went to the International AIDS Conference, and I believe that you did, and I think everybody was really very sort of impressed and excited by the notion that we can, in fact, create an AIDS-free generation, that we now certainly have the medical tools to do this if we can, you know, deliver medical care and treatment to large numbers of people, both, you know, globally and in the United States. And as you point out, there are a substantial number of people with HIV, even in the United States, who don't know their HIV status and who are not engaged in any form of care and treatment for it. The reasons for that certainly include stigma, and I completely agree with you. They also have to do with, you know, sort of related issues of poverty, mental health and substance abuse issues, a lack of knowledge about sort of the benefits of being involved in HIV treatment and care, and a variety of things. So I think a lot of people sort of thought, were extremely excited about the prospect of this, and then sort of wondered, how will we actually accomplish it? And I wonder what your thoughts are about sort of where we would start. And I would also ask you sort of how you believe that, you know, the members of the audience here tonight and members of the radio audience can participate in sort of the goal of helping us to, in fact, create the first AIDS-free generation.
So, you know, I agree. It seems daunting, even overwhelming, to decide how to start. What is the entry point? What can we do now? And this really is why I tried to focus on stigma, because I think that we all participate in stigmatizing processes, and we can stop immediately. So, you know, if you want a short list of ideas about what to do about stigma, I would suggest the following. One, everyone should get an HIV test. I submit that everyone needs to know whether they're infected with HIV or not, but they also need to know what it feels like to be HIV tested. And they need to talk about their testing experience with your friends and your family, and you need to encourage your friends to be tested. I think we can test to end stigma. At this point, the idea that testing is only for people at risk is really off-putting, and it doesn't help build the kind of broad coalition that we need to actually address this epidemic. As you know, we can enjoy great benefits from rolling out treatment, but only if people get tested and know whether they're HIV infected and get into care. So if you, when you get HIV tested, find that you're HIV negative, I think you should consider taking PrEP, the HIV prevention pill. PrEP is highly effective if taken consistently, and it will help you stay free of HIV. Taking PrEP is a way of being responsible. Now, you may not need to take PrEP because your potential for HIV exposure is low, and you can talk to your friends and your counselors about that. Nonetheless, I think even if your potential exposure to HIV is low, you should still consider taking PrEP. That consideration, the thought process, will be your opportunity to think about HIV, think about the drugs, think about your agreements with your partner or your partners. All of this is helpful, not just for you, but for everyone in your life. Uninfected people taking HIV drugs to stay free of HIV can help destigmatize the people who take the drugs for therapy. So PrEP is a vehicle for destigmatization of therapy. If you're HIV positive, consider taking therapy. Therapy preserves the immune system, makes you less susceptible to tuberculosis, prolongs your life, and makes you less infectious for your partners. Getting treated is an act to end stigma, and to save your life, partly because it eliminates the line between HIV positives and negatives. A positive with no viral load because of therapy are ambassadors in the war on stigma. If you're afraid, find a friend. If you do not know whether your friend is afraid of HIV, find out. Talk to your friends about HIV. And talk to everyone you know about HIV, not just the people that you think might be at risk. In fact, we're all citizens of this society, and we're on the verge of ending, or could be on the verge of ending, one of the worst pandemics in human history. I think we should all try to be part of that process.
I attended the FDA hearing to consider whether or not to approve Truvada for PrEP, and was really stunned then, and I continue to be stunned by sort of comments that I hear from people who, you know, even work in the HIV prevention field, that revealed kind of a, speaking of stigma, I mean, just kind of a profound mistrust of people who might benefit from PrEP, suggesting that, you know, all these people really want to do is go out and have unbridled, unprotected sex, and we are simply handing them the thing that will allow them to do it when they could just use condoms, which, you know, some people believe are, you know, effective all the time. I found it really shocking, and I was sort of reminded of, and am continually reminded in discussions about PrEP, about the pill. The first pill, the birth control pill, and sort of the panic and the morality and everything that surrounded that, which hasn't completely gone away, but our experience of the pill, I think, has shown that it is not necessarily sort of the nightmare that people initially predicted. I also find a lot of, you know, people in prevention who kind of essentially feel that we shouldn't advance PrEP and that we shouldn't necessarily even let people know about it. And so I'm kind of reminded of the notion of choice and allowing people to have information about all of the evidence-based prevention interventions that are available to them and then decide. So I wonder what you have to, what you think about the current debate about PrEP in the context of some of these things that have come before us.
Well, again, this notion that birth control pills was going to set people loose to have much more sex than they would otherwise have really runs counter to most of the evidence. I mean, there's much talk about the sexual revolution of the 60s, but first of all, it wasn't very well studied, and as nearly as we can tell, there wasn't a substantial increase in the numbers of partners or in sexual practices. So I think that the pill just decreased, the birth control pill just ended up decreasing pregnancy rates and gave women more control over their sexuality, but you know, sexual practices, numbers of partners remained roughly the same. And this is what we see in our HIV prevention trials, that this notion that, you know, people are waiting for a new pill to go out and have the sex lives they want is just not in evidence. People, we think, are pretty much already having the sex life that they want to the extent that they can make it happen. These pills just make it safer by preventing pregnancy and HIV. But you're right, there's in discussions about PrEP, there's an underlying assumption made that people will be irresponsible. And we, in fact, see the opposite, that the people who take PrEP are going out of their way to protect themselves and their lovers from acquiring HIV. As for condoms, clearly condoms are our best friend. They prevent HIV transmission when used consistently. They also prevent a host of other sexually transmitted infections. They can prevent pregnancy if that's not desired. So condoms are very helpful, but they're not always used, and we're just now beginning to understand the circumstances in which condoms are not used. And one issue that comes up time and time again, people will say, I was fine using condoms every single time, and then I fell in love. And I fell in love. I wanted to have greater intimacy. I wanted to have a different kind of sex with my partner. And, you know, I think that we cannot really be against love. That's not going to be a popular approach, and we're not going to win over friends for the war against HIV if we take a position against love. And it's really love that does away with condoms more often than not. So I think we're better off acknowledging that there are times in which condoms aren't used, encouraging people who are in love to really discuss explicitly with their partners what's going on, what kinds of other partnerships are involved. But I think that PrEP is clearly an option there. And another, you know, clear example is couples who desire pregnancy. And PrEP has been studied in that setting, where, you know, the man is positive or the woman's positive and they want to have babies. And using condoms is a non-starter. It's going to interfere with procreation. And so PrEP becomes a real option there. The only other option is sperm washing, but the safety and efficacy of sperm washing has never been rigorously evaluated. Plus, it's very difficult to get access to. PrEP is a very helpful option in that setting. So I think you're right. And, you know, but again, we often lament that demand and use of prevention strategies is low. And yet, what should we expect if we, you know, offend people with words like calling them risky, or if we sort of denigrate the value of the options that we have? I mean, people will walk away. And so I think that at this point, we really do need to foster a real interest in using something. And it can be anything. And it doesn't even, it can be a condom, it can be PrEP, it can be talking to your partner about their HIV status, it can be negotiating and updating your agreement with that partner regarding safety and outside partnerships, it can be a variety of things. But everyone now has at least one and probably two ways that are very attractive to them for preventing HIV transmission. We should encourage people to use something rather than telling them, you know, what's good for them.
Let me turn to some questions from our audience. The first one, tonight you mention that PrEP may be 99% effective against HIV transmission, at least in gay men. This number has rarely been discussed or reported, especially to men trying to avoid becoming HIV positive, if at all. The number that is most reported is 44% efficacy in, you know, many articles that you read. Can you sort of tell us why it is that we see different numbers floating around about the effectiveness of PrEP?
It depends how effectiveness is defined. There's really two questions to be asked from two different perspectives. One is, what is the impact of offering people PrEP? And there we found that there was a 44% reduction in HIV acquisition associated with offering people the opportunity to take PrEP. But that isn't really the perspective that most potential users have. The potential users want to know, what can I expect if I take it? And the 99% is that. So it's a 99% reduction in HIV risk if you take it daily. So from the perspective of the user, it's a 99% reduction. From the perspective of the provider, you need to be aware that offering PrEP to 100 people, so far maybe half will choose to take it. And that, you know, we understand why that can occur. Some people faced between taking a pill every day and using condoms will choose condoms, either because they're not in love or they don't, you know, they like condoms. And there's lots of reasons to like condoms. Let me emphasize that. But only about half of people that we offered PrEP to actually took it. But those who took it received very tremendous benefits.
Another question. The United States and even the University of California, San Francisco, are at the forefront of HIV-related research, how does the U.S. compare to other progressive Western countries in this regard, either in basic science or prevention science related to HIV?
Well, I think the U.S. Plays a leadership role in a variety of different respects. Our National Institutes of Health and Centers for Disease Control are focused on HIV as a major problem of our time, and so they've really provided leadership and funding to make it happen. I think that the limitations in the U.S. are mainly related to implementation, and we're hoping that we can correct those deficiencies now that we have a healthcare system embodied by the Affordable Health Care Act. We really now, for the first time, have the ability to think about ways to optimize healthcare in a way that stops the epidemic in our country. So I would say research-wise, we've played a leadership role. In terms of implementation, we've been held back by the lack of a true healthcare system, but that now is being remedied.
Another guest asks whether the epidemic can really be, we've talked quite a bit about sort of the domestic epidemic, but whether the epidemic at large can really be stopped without a much more aggressive and comprehensive effort in the developing world. The PEPFAR and the Global Fund are huge programs to address the global situation, and you practiced in Uganda for a while. Is this sufficient to accomplish what we need to do?
Well, yes. I think clearly the majority of HIV transmission events are occurring outside of the United States. As I said, 50,000 new infections per year in the U.S., 2.5 million overall around the world. So the majority of people who are infected in Africa, the continent, continents of Asia and South America are also highly impacted. This does require a global response, and I think fundraising for the global response is a critically important activity that we can all engage in. But I would also argue that we have to show the world that we can end this epidemic at home. In the United States, we do have an epidemic that's out of control. We can generate all of the resources needed to provide all the necessary services. I think that people around the world will not really believe that this epidemic can end until we can show that we've done it in the United States. And so I think that we do need to focus on our domestic epidemic. I think we need to show people that it can be done here and how it can be done here. The process of trying to end the epidemic in the U.S. will teach us a huge amount about how to address stigma, how to most efficiently offer all the different options that people have now to stop transmission and to get on therapy. I think that we would do well to show folks that we can do it here, and then that becomes a model for the rest of the world.
Yeah, and just an additional note of optimism, I think. There are two places where we really are seeing, you know, much greater control of the epidemic, with much larger numbers of people, you know, engaged in care and treatment, much better viral suppression, sharply reduced new rates of new infections. Those two places are San Francisco and Massachusetts. And this results really, I think, primarily from very aggressive testing campaigns, encouraging people to know their status, offering treatment early, and, you know, sort of encouraging people to think about being treated very early, and universal access to healthcare, both Healthy San Francisco in San Francisco and Romney Care in Massachusetts, interestingly. So there is some evidence that this can, in fact, be done. Our last question, the Centers for Disease Control just released their latest report indicating a troubling rise in new HIV infections among young people. And we know that there's a, you know, very serious problem of new HIV cases among young gay men of color, and particularly young African-American gay men. The CDC does not promote the prevention pill or PrEP or the use of condoms. Why is that? They also mentioned that youth groups should stop having sex and be abstinent. What about a greater level of education for this population?
So there was a moment in U.S. history in which the CDC was asked not to promote condoms and to focus only on decreasing the amount of sexual activity. Fortunately, that era is over, we believe. The CDC does recommend PrEP for gay men and HIV-discordant couples, but they also emphasize that condoms are the first line of defense and that they are effective for preventing HIV and that they prevent a variety of other diseases, but that among people who are not using condoms consistently for whatever reason, PrEP should be seriously considered. So that's the current CDC position on it. But, you know, I think the point is that the CDC, although, you know, I think heroically focused on public health, is also vulnerable to political influence and the fact that we have gone through political periods where they were told not to promote condoms, and then, you know, a new president's elected and condoms are now a good thing again, really reflects the fact that we have politics all over our healthcare system, including our public health approaches to HIV prevention. And so that is an opportunity for engaged citizens to know what's going on, to contact their elected representatives to make sure that they're on the side of public health approaches that you agree with.
Thank you. And let me just finish by saying, you know how important I believe the results of IPREX are and the great potential that PrEP has for, along with treating HIV-positive people for their infection to help us stop this epidemic. And I'm always proud to be able to have a conversation with you about this. So I want to thank our guest for the evening, Dr. Robert Grant, and also our audience here. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 109th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.